Good afternoon. I'm Fiona Branton, president of the Harvard Law School Forum, and I'd like to welcome you all here today. We're pleased to have with us today Mr. Dennis Conner, skipper of the Stars and Stripes. Our guest today is from San Diego. He's a businessman, author, and lecturer, considers himself an ambassador from Australia. He holds two honorary doctorates and is the only person to have his picture on the cover of Sports Illustrated with the President of the United States. He's been sailing since he was 4 years old. Got into it because his father was a fisherman, and has since then made it his career. He's won the America's Cup 4 times, right? And and hopes to extend his streak with another win. We don't know where, but
I'll tell you all about it.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to introduce Dennis Conner.
Thank you, Fiona. I don't know if this is the best way to come to Harvard or not, or if it's better to be actually admitted by, you know, submitting your application, but at least it's one way to be here. I've had a chance to sail on the Charles River a few times, so that's about the second closest time, place I've been. And I don't think you really came here to hear about my carpet and drapery business, so I guess I'll tell you a little bit about the America's Cup and why it's interesting today and what's kind of going on, and then if you all have any questions, I'll see what I can do about answering it. I think that one of the things that you'll enjoy most is that a lot of people think that the America's Cup really is a sailing contest. And it's really not like what you all would really think about is sailing and what you've seen with your peers or your friends or your family when you've gone out and raced sailboats. That's not really what the America's Cup has come to be. And it really hasn't ever been that way. It has a history of starting in 1852, and the competition has been a lot more than sailing ever since that. It involved design and logistics. It used to be that people had to sail all the way across the Atlantic when they competed from England by the rules. They couldn't put it on a ship or whatever. And when they first started racing, they had like 24 boats out there racing against the one single challenger. So the rules have changed a little bit. But generally, they've always been a little stacked in favor of the person making the rules. And it was kind of the golden rule: he who had the gold made the rules. And over the years, the competition changed and became relatively more even. And but it was sailing, and the competition really started like May of the year of the event, and they sailed during the summer and had the event. And it was something that the rich people really did, generally from New York, where they'd use this as an excuse to come up to Newport, Rhode Island, for the summer and have a social scene and have a good time, and they'd win the cup every year, and that was kind of how it was, ho-hum. But after the war being World War II, the competition really didn't exist from 1938 till the war ended all the competition. In about 1958, they said, hey, let's dust off the America's Cup and have some competition. So they renewed it, and they were racing in these 12-meter boats, which some of you have seen. They're about 70 feet long and have a crew of 11 and mast about 100 feet. And they go along nicely, but they're not anything spectacular. That was the vehicle for competition. And slowly, there was more interest worldwide. And then it grew into something where it was the longest winning streak in sports history. And it was something that was worth going after for whatever reason. Alan Bond came and raced for it in 1983. And I think that was really where it came out of its infancy. It went from like tennis and what golf did and what some other sports have done in recent history, where the public really became aware of it and it became of interest. So what really happened is it took losing for the America's Cup to come of age and for most people to really care about it. Up till then, it was complacency. You read about it maybe one day or 2 days in the New York Times, and generally, ho-hum, America wins again, you know, 24 times they've defended the America's Cup. So it was never really a sailboat race. It always had a lot of politics involved, and it always really had money involved at that time. You couldn't just go and race in the America's Cup if you were a good sailor. You had to know somebody that was rich. Since that time, what it's come to be in this modern age, what we're talking about now is really a game of life as opposed to a sailboat race. And if you picture a pie, if you will, that's split up here, the actual sailing itself and the crew and what the crew is involved with may be like 15% or 20% of the pie that really determine the results. The major items, as it's turned out now, are design and technology involved in building the product and fundraising, marketing, if you will. It's like any other business. If you have a good mousetrap, where are you going to get the money to develop it and merchandise it? So money is certainly very important. And then you have the logistics involved and competing and operating. In our case, in 1987, it was halfway around the world in Perth, Western Australia. And then you have scouting or industrial espionage, and you have all the other factors that are non-yachting oriented that go into this. And then the guys kind of joke about, oh, by the way, we do have to go sailing. But the event itself is really won, like the event for 1991, which is when the next one will take place, is really being won right now. And it's being won by the planning. What type of plan do you have? And the staffing. Are you going to rely on technology, and how much on technology, and who's going to run the technology, and who's going to be on that team? And by the fundraising, how are you going to raise the money? How much are you going to raise, and how are you going to do it? Will it be successful? You set your goals too high, maybe you won't be able to make it. And if you set them too low, you won't have enough to accomplish everything you want. Who's going to be in your crew? Who's going to be the head of your syndicate? Who's going to be involved from an administrative standpoint and a spokesman standpoint in your relations with the media? These are all questions that have to be answered now. And how we do at staffing and answering these questions now, you'll see out on the water in 1991. Because that's really... So what we're talking about here is not just the sailing contest, as it appeared to you that watched it on television last February. It looked like, oh, this is nice and interesting. It's sailboat going fast through the water and friendly competition between nations. It's really not. And the reason that it's not is because, in addition to being involved with the national pride and spirit of a country, like what we saw happen when the Australians won, when they took this cup away from us in 1983 and they took it down to Australia, it was like the biggest thing that had ever happened to Australia. It was bigger than winning the Davis Cup in tennis. There was a national holiday proclaimed by Prime Minister Hawke. And it was a national celebration. They had 200,000 people greeted Alan Bond and the guys when they came back with the cup. Because what this did to... In addition to physically bringing the cup back there after 132 years, the longest winning streak in sports history, what it did is it made the people of that country come together and feel really good about themselves, and that they could go and compete against America and all that America stands for from a standpoint of technology and money and power and controlling the rules. And this little Australia with 18 million people could go over there and win against all odds. I mean, it did tremendous things for their pride and spirit. And to a lesser extent, I think it did something similar in 1987 when we brought the cup back. Americans seemed to like the idea of us going down there and competing halfway around the world and restoring a bit of our heritage. I mean, it's only a little silver cup. You think about it. I mean, why can we get so excited about it? But it is interesting from what it can do from bringing a nation together and feeling good about itself. It's giving them something that they can feel warm and look upon with favor. So that is a factor, but it's also become an economic prize, and perhaps the biggest economic prize in sport. I'm not sure what the owner of a team that will win this World Series will get. I read somewhere that the players may receive something in the neighborhood of $80,000 out of their share of the winning purse, if you will, from the attendance. I'm not sure what the owner gets. He probably gets some share of that also. When you win the Super Bowl, you get something along the same lines. That is good. When you win the Indianapolis 500, maybe there's a couple $100,000 prize. You all probably could think of some prizes that where the economic benefit might be $1 million for winning. What do they get when they win a pro boxing fight? I don't know what Biggs or Holmes or these guys get, but somewhere you read purses $10, $20 million involved, and they split that up. We'll give you some idea what the America's Cup is worth when you win. It brought $1 billion worth of new, fresh dollars to the economy of Perth, Western Australia over a three-year period. And the summation came from the competitors themselves bringing about $200 million to Perth. There was 20 competitors. They made maybe 25 competitors. They spent between $15 and $20 million each. There were tourists that brought $650 million to the area over a three-year period, and business investments that brought another couple hundred million dollars. So they brought $1 billion worth of new, fresh dollars to Perth that would otherwise wouldn't have been there. And I'm not an economist. I'm not smart, but I understand that the from our people in San Diego at the Tourist Bureau, that these dollars, fresh dollars, and tourist dollars turn over somewhere around four times in our environment. So just if you'll let me surmise that this brought somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 billion worth of gross national product to the Western Australia, I would suggest that it would do the same to California when the event goes there. So if you work on that premise again, sales tax in California is 6%. So the state of California is going to get 6% of $4 billion to their coffers. That's $240 million. Now, I'm not talking income tax now, or property taxes. We're talking just sales tax alone, windfall profit of $240 million for the state of California. They don't have to provide any more schools. They don't have to provide any more transportation. No more administration. So it's almost a net profit, bottom line, net. And there are no taxes they have to pay either. So this is a big deal to the state of California. And now if you talk San Diego, what happens there? Well, just think what will happen when all those tourists come there. And now you find out you all come from all over the country. You know, there's a lot of nice places that you haven't seen. Well, people are going to go to San Diego, and they're going to find out San Diego is a darn nice place to go, because it is. It's one of the nicest cities in the world. And they're going to find the ambiance is nice, and the weather is nice, the people are friendly, there's Sea World, there's the ocean, there's Mexico, there's skiing an hour away, a lot of nice things. They're going to come back, and there's going to be a lot of business people that are going to go to San Diego, and they're going to find out this environment is healthy. There is low unemployment. There are opportunities here. And besides, it wouldn't be a bad place to have a branch. So they're going to invest there. It's got long-term advantages to the economic that we'll never be able to put a finger on. To say nothing of what it's going to do for the jobs that were created, the 60,000 new jobs that are created. They're not all going to vanish when the America's Cup leaves. So you can see economically it's a tremendous prize to win. Now, you can now get an idea of why people like the Aga Khan, who is the spiritual leader of 250 million Muslims around the world, who owns the island of Sardinia off the coast of Rome, why he's interested in playing this game. Why Kobayashi, a rich Japanese businessman with an island off the coast of Tokyo, is spending $60 million trying to win the America's Cup. Why the whole New Zealand government is into this. But through the Bank of New Zealand sponsoring the New Zealand effort, they spent $20 million last time. They're going to spend $40 million now. They're even suing us trying to get the cup. Why? Think what you can do with this cup if you can use it to create the infrastructure of a whole new city, a whole island, develop that and to attract the capital necessary to provide the infrastructure, the hotels, the hospitals, the stores, the golf courses, the five-star hotels, the airport, to develop your island. It's mind-boggling how much your real estate would be worth. So you can see why these people are playing. Why are the most intelligent, most powerful, some of the most powerful people in the world playing this game? Why is Alan Bond in it? Why is the King of Spain in this? But it's because not only does it have the pride and the spirit and the ego and the tremendous visibility worldwide, but it's got a tremendous economic impact with winning it. Okay, so with that in mind, that's what the cup is now. That's what we're racing for, and that's when you see, well, Dennis Conner involved in the America's Cup. That's why when I tell you that it's far more than a sailboat race, why it is. Okay, so now if you want to win this prize, how do you go about doing it? Well, first of all, you learn from the past. That's a good way to look. In 1983, we lost the America's Cup because we made one big mistake. We were a little complacent, as I mentioned to you before. The people that were backing it were complacent. The people who were giving the money were complacent. And some of the sailors were complacent. Maybe I was complacent. One of the biggest mistakes we made was we didn't have good industrial espionage. We didn't have it in our budget, and we didn't have it in reality, in real life. The Australians were developing in secret, see, a wing keel. I don't know how many of you sail here. Well, this, if imagine the keel of the boat, the underbody of the boat with wings on the bottom. It was unheard of. If somebody had told me in 1983, in January of 1983, that a boat with a wing keel was going to win the America's Cup, I would have thought they were nuts. It shows you what I know. I didn't even know what I didn't know. And when I did hear about it, I thought they were nuts until I saw the boat actually sailing and I saw it going out there and beating the hell out of all of its competition. Then it dawned on me, we're in trouble here. It took beating me over the head with a stick to figure it out. But I figured it out. I lost the America's Cup. And it's pretty obvious to us that we're racing on that boat on Liberty in the 1983 America's Cup that we weren't racing apples and apples. This boat was fast. So, okay, we've lost the cup, and now we're sitting on our rear ends feeling sorry for ourselves. What are the options? To stay there and read about it in the paper in 1987, or get up off our fannies and see what we can do about winning it back? Well, obviously, for me, it was a lot more satisfying to fight and go down there and do something about bringing it home. Okay, so that's the first thing you've got to have. You've got to have that commitment, that desire to establish your priorities. And then what? Well, the next thing you need is a plan. And just like anything else, some of you are going to go into business and you're going to need a plan. Well, we had a plan, and the easy part of our plan was that we just got beat by somebody with a faster boat, and they didn't just happen. They relied on technology. They didn't just have a single architect from New York drawing this boat in his bathroom and out of the seat of his pants and send it over to the builder. They had a plan. They went to the Dutch. They had an idea of this wing keel, and they went to the Dutch, and they had the Dutch research this thing in their test tank, in their computer, and they ran model after model, and they refined it all in secrecy. And they came and beat us with it. Technology, technology, technology. So our big part of our plan relied on coming up with a fast boat. We just got beat by a fast boat. We knew sailing skill. That all sounds great. Think, oh, just go beat them. You're better. Well, that's BS. You can't go and do that. And we found out. We knew we had to have a fast boat. So we structured our plan with everything we had in the beginning, all the money, all the energy, every bit of wherewithal we could muster to come up with a fast boat, because we knew the racing in Australia was going to be such where there weren't a lot of wind shift. Either you've been sailing out here on the Charles. No, I mean, the race is not always to the swift. It's to the smart or the lucky, the guy that goes and gets the wind shift and wins. Well, those don't happen in Australia. It was going to be boat speed, and boat speed. So that was the first key part of our plan, was to have a fast boat and to get it by relying on technology. So how did we do that? Well, we knew we had to think outside of the box and look in some other areas. So we decided we'd rely on a team of three naval architects. Well, that's never been done before. Imagine trying to get three Picassos together and try to agree on any painting and see what you'd get. You'd have a mess. The guy with the strongest personality would win. The other two would say, hell with you guys, you just do it. I don't want to be involved. Well, that's one little problem. These guys all had great egos. And then you get the best of the world and anything else involved. You get NASA, Boeing, Grumman, all these AeroVironment, all these gurus. They all are smart as hell. try to get them to agree on anything. I mean, imagine the management problem you've got here. Well, it's one thing to get the guys to sign up. It's another thing to get a product that's halfway decent. How do you manage these guys? Well, the key was people. We had a great manager, and he did a good job, and they designed us a good product. And it was spot on from the beginning. They were able to tap into Boeing's computer codes that design wings of an airplane and make that work so they could design the wing of our keel. They were able to tap into the codes of Science Application Incorporated from La Jolla that helped us design the hull at low drag, high lift hull, and so on. And they came up with a good boat. That was a key part of our plan. The next part of the plan involved marketing. In 1983, we lost the cup with the New York Yacht Club. They didn't want anything to do with us. Dennis, you're a loser. No, please, they didn't even want to go to the press conference. They wanted to get as far away from me as they could. So here I'm starting out all by myself. I'm in the carpet drapery business, you know. I don't have any money. My father was a fisherman. So where do you go for the money? That's not an easy question. In the beginning, the New York Yacht Club was saying, to all of my former backers, well, you went with Dennis last time, and look what he got you. Come with us. Corporate America, you know, they all like, corporate America, they like winners, I'll tell you that. They're not interested in losing. That doesn't sell product. So when I went there, I had, my hand out, please, help me, I can win. It was a tough sell, especially in the beginning. But slowly we managed to get some people to come aboard that personally that donated to our tax, to our 502c3, those of you that are in tax planning, with a 7-year exemption. And we slowly got corporate America. Edsel Ford, I'll give Edsel credit. He believed in me. He said, Dennis, I think you can do it. He's not a sailor. He took a chance. Merrill Lynch, Bill Shire and Dan Tully, they took a chance. Slowly we built some momentum, got Budweiser. They're a big leader in the marketing department. People say, well, Budweiser knows what they're doing. They wouldn't go with a loser. They must sign on. So after we got Budweiser, we got Pepsi, and then we got Wrigley's, and then we got Sprint. Slowly we got enough money. Well, it was a struggle the whole time. But without the help of several thousands of people from across the country, and without corporate America, we never would have been able to do it. Wouldn't it matter if we'd had the fastest boat and the best sailors in the world? Without the dough, how are we going to build the boat? How are we going to compete halfway around the world? So that was a key part of the program. It doesn't have much to do with sailing. A lot to do with salesmanship. BS. But we got it. Then the next interesting part, which is the same as business, what it really comes down to, we're not in the sailing business, we're in the people business. People, people, and people. Any of you have been involved in a team sport? No, it's not, no matter how good you are. Look at the last football strike. I mean, one guy cannot make the team. Danny White, got beat from Dallas with a couple of his regulars by a team of fired up replacements. One guy can't do this. It's a team. And the people are critical. The staffing. This wasn't just a Dennis Conner victory. This was a victory for the entire Stars and Stripes team and for America. And the way we got this team was that we recruited well. And the way we recruited was we used the formula that has worked well for me in the past, and that is that not to have people on this team that don't have the same kind of goals that I did and didn't have that same commitment to winning this. Because if they didn't have the commitment, they couldn't have put up with all the crap that goes with it. So the way we recruited people is if they wanted to give up everything in their lives, you guys want to drop out of school, don't see your family, give up your girlfriend, don't play golf or tennis, forget about watching television. All you want to do for 24 hours a day is work on the America's Cup. Then we'd give them a tryout. And later, after we got to know each other better and we, we're all a big family, the guy said, Dennis, we ought to be committed for our commitment to the commitment. And they might be right. But after working from 5 in the morning till 9 at night, getting down there and doing their aerobic or Nautilus exercises in the morning, getting the boat in the water, putting the computer on there, the sails, the equipment, sailing all day, coming back, repairing it all, checking the sails, getting the batteries off there and charging them, putting the input into the computer, checking the mast, and getting home and having dinner and crew meetings from until 9 o'clock at night. They did that literally 7 days a week, 31 days a month, for 17 months leading up to this America's Cup, and they got $300 a month financially. So that's why they had to be committed to this. They had to have this as their number one priority in life. How else could they have put up with it? All that was forgotten when we crossed that finish line ahead and whipping the Australians 4-0. And they put that American flag up the backstay and the tears came and their high fives. All those sacrifices were gone. Because there's something very, very powerful being part of that, of a team where everyone is pulling together at personal, great personal sacrifice, all at the same job. It's a very, very powerful thing. And it was all worth it for them. But the reason that they had to have, without that proper setting of their goals and priorities, and you all are going to be in the process of reevaluating your goals and priorities, and one of your recent goals has been to graduate from law school, and you're almost there. I mean, you wouldn't be here 90% of the way. So now you got to reestablish what your goals are. Do you want to be like a regular person and have a regular family and use your degree to make enough money so you can have a nice house and you have your tickets to the football game every year and have a family and settle down? Or do you want to use your degree to become something special in business or whatever you want to do? You're going to have to set these goals. So some of you are going to want to set your goals so that something has a very high priority to you and it's focused. It has a high priority. Or some of you are going to want to have like a regular life, is what people would call a regular life, with a broad base of priorities, and try to do a good job in all of those. But I'll tell you one thing, the sooner you decide that whatever it is, the better you'll be. The sooner you decide if you want tunnel vision and you want something special and start working on that, the better off you'll be. So aside from that, getting back to the cup itself, we had the guys with the tunnel vision, and they worked their fannies off in Hawaii, set for 17 months before the event. And the reason Hawaii was because that was the next part of our plan. Operationally, we had to have a plan. Where are you going to practice? Well, we chose Hawaii for two or three big reasons. First, it was part of the United States of America. And believe me, there is a lot of pride of ownership in this and a lot of pride in winning it. And if we had practiced in Australia, although it's a fantastic country, super, the people couldn't be more gracious. They're very sports-minded. The people are great. Great hosts, friendly, outgoing, warm. It's a super place to go. Bear in mind, this is still the home of our sailing enemy. And they want to win. And so from a standpoint of everything we were doing, we'd be right there. We'd be visible. From a standpoint of them having people in our camp, looking at our equipment, knowing our plans, seeing our computers, our sails, our spars, everything going on. I'm sure it would have been a lot easier if we were down there. If they wanted to have a submarine with a camera on it, taking a picture of our keel, would have been a lot easier if they'd known where we were leaving the harbor than in Honolulu, where there's Honolulu Harbor. It's a big place. If they wanted to see our techniques, it would certainly have been a lot easier for them to do that when we were next door instead of having to travel 9,037 hours away to see us. And when they got there, the customs people called up and said, "By the way, Stars and Stripes, my boys, there's some bros over here that don't look like they're speaking your language." Or the helicopter service calls up and says, "Guys, you got a spy out there tomorrow at 10 o'clock. He just booked us." Or the guys chartering the boat would call up. We're home, in other words. This was our home. And those guys knew we were serious about winning. We were racing for America. And they were trying to whip us. So Hawaii was America. That was one big advantage. Second big advantage was that time is always something that we ran out of in the America's Cup. No matter what, you had to be ready to race. October 15th, 1986, you had to enter the first race. So the bar, that was it. If you weren't there, it's so long, Chago. It's too bad. So you always run out of time. And a lot of people in our effort that were important, our technicians, our sailmakers, some of our boat builders, our designers, had regular grown-up jobs, and they couldn't be part of this every day like they like. So maybe they could give us 10 days a month. Well, bear in mind, if they had to travel to Perth, it would have taken 2 extra days further than Australia, going and 2 days back. I mean, that's a long way down there. That's 4 days of their 10 they can work for us. Which is better, to have 6 days a month or 10 days a month when they can get to Hawaii overnight from anywhere and fly Chicago-Honolulu and be there at night? And you can get Chicago-Honolulu at night the next coming back. So we got all 10 days of our subcontractors' time. So logistically, it was very important to get our sails, our computers, our equipment in a timely manner. So that was the number two reason why Hawaii was good. And the third reason Hawaii was good was because we didn't sail in the World's Championships, which were held the year prior to the event, because we were in Hawaii. If we had been in Perth, we would have sailed. And if we had sailed, our boats were the right length to win, as time has told us now. If we had sailed in the World's Championships leading up to the event itself, we would have won the World's Championships, and everybody down there would have known that our large, relatively unmaneuverable boats were fast as hell in a straight line, and they could have built them. We might have seen a different result a year later in the Cup itself. So those were three major factors involved. Then the next thing that was important that happened is we went down to Perth. We had the right boat for strong winds, and we had a plan. And our plan didn't involve using all of our best equipment until we needed it. Our New Zealanders friends came down there and they put their pedal to the metal in the beginning and they won all the races. So we got to go over there and study them and watch what they had. Look at their sails, their equipment, their rudder, their masts, their spars, their winglets, their operation, their practicing techniques, their sailing techniques. We got to study all that, so we upgraded our program. We went down there, and having been there before, we knew the name of the game was to win the America's Cup, not to win every race. All we had to do was be in the top four to qualify for the quarterfinals, and then we started fresh. So we only used what we needed to get to the quarterfinals. We ended up second, but we had a little more Tony to put in the tank when we needed it. So that was a key part of the plan. Again, the plan and the maturity to execute the plan. And while we were along that way there, we had a few dips and do's here, like the stock market yesterday. We had a few little downers that looked pretty important to a crew that had never been there before. Some of our guys were new. They hadn't all sailed in the America's Cup before. And they were a little down. You know, they were a little worried. We're right in the pack here. We have to be in the top four. But because they had a very good feeling about themselves and their teammates, they weren't down for long. They bounced right back. And they really psychologically were there to win. They had a very good self-image. After all, they were the best team. They had the best designers. They had the best managers. They had the most veteran crew. They knew their boat was fast as heck in a strong wind. And they knew we had a few more things left to show we hadn't shown. And they'd been out practicing for the last 17 months. They knew if the sail broke, they could change that faster than you could say Jack Robinson. They were the best. Nothing that Dennis could do. It's hairy moves or screwball ideas he came up with. There wasn't anything they couldn't handle. They had a great image. And so they were ready. And so when they had a little bumps along the way, they had a great feeling about themselves and their team. So we had tremendous morale, and that was a key part. Because we're down there operating in a foreign country, 12,000 miles from home, 12 hours time difference from here. You can't call your friends. You don't see your newspapers. You haven't talked to your girlfriend in 3 weeks. I mean, on and on and on. You're reading about you're the bad guy in all the newspapers? That's not fun. You're the enemy down here trying to take away their cup? So this is all important to keep psychologically at your best so that you could go out and perform well physically. All this came together at the right time. We raced the New Zealanders in the semifinals. We put in our best mast. We changed our winglets and made them wider. Used our better sails. Changed the rudder. Put on some fancy skin that made the boat go faster. And went out there and beat the hell out of them. And then we went on, and we knew we were going to win the America's Cup if we could beat the other challengers, because we'd been practicing against Alan Bond almost every day, and we knew we were faster than he was, even though we didn't let him know that, because we held back a little most of the time. So we knew if we could race the Australians, they were in a lot of trouble. We went out there, and frankly, we could have even gone faster than we did in the America's Cup, because we were very conservative. We didn't take any chances. I didn't try to get the best start. I knew the boat we could win. I'm a very aggressive person at the starting line normally with equal boats. But I didn't try to take advantage of the kid over there on the other side. I knew all we had to do was go out there and get the boat across the starting line and let it do its thing. Maturity. We had a plan. And it all worked out. We all know, unfortunately, you know, we won 4-0 and came home and everything was fantastic. We had no idea that people in America were going to care about it like they had. 1983, they didn't seem to care much. When 1980, I won the America's Cup in 1980. I got maybe 200 cards and letters that said, "Dennis, nice job." Big deal, right? We had no idea we were going to come home to a ticker tape parade down Fifth Avenue. And you know, I had a pretty good idea that the president would call, because I promised him when we lost that we'd get it back. But it was still a fantastic welcome. And we came home, and now there's still tremendous pride amongst the country, and not just the rich people. It's the people in the street, not just sports people. It's the housewives. They all feel good about the America's Cup, and now it's something, it's a spectacular sporting event. So that, coupled that it has such tremendous visibility, people enjoyed watching it on ESPN. People that weren't sailors now know that it is not just something rich people do. It's a real sport. The whole world cares about it, including the Iron Curtain countries who are talking about entering. It's going to be a spectacular event. Most certainly it will be 1991 in San Diego. The event will be relatively light winds compared to what you saw in Australia, but it will still be exciting because you'll have cameras on the boats and you'll hear Dennis talking to his tactician saying, "Holy crap in Italy, why didn't you tell me there was more wind over there as they sail by?" I mean, any of you sail with your wives, your girlfriends, or your father screaming at you, I mean, you'll see that same kind of emotions. And we don't have ice water for in our blood. We're human. So you'll hear a few little anxious moments. It'll be fun for you to watch. You can come and be part of it. It'll be great. There will most certainly be a tremendous amount of competition on the foreign side of things. There's three Japanese efforts, each fully funded at $60 million each. The Canadians will be there, four British efforts. The Swedes, Denmark, Spain, West Germany, Italy, France, New Zealand, Australia, perhaps Hong Kong. There'll be 24 challengers that will put in their bid here in the next couple of weeks. And certainly half a dozen will be super strong, and another half a dozen with a chance of winning. Bear in mind, we're talking about technology here, and whoever happens to turn over that lucky rock and comes up with a boat with no keel at all, but three rudders, one sticking out the front, the back, and the side, or comes up with a sail that is three-dimensional instead of one-dimensional and gets a super amount of lift over something that no one ever dreamed of, or a mast that can stand up without any shrouds. Somebody like that can win. So it's going to be a great competition, and it's going to take an effort on the American side. It's going to be equally strong to defend successfully. We are the underdogs as we speak. So our goals have to be not only continue to do everything we did last time, but we have to redouble our efforts. If we have a lead, we better maintain the lead. That's the challenge. Do not get complacent. Do not take anything for granted. Look twice under every rock. Make sure you have enough money. Don't have any of you smart people here thinking, "Well, I have a good idea, but I wonder if I should really write him. He's probably got it all covered. He doesn't need it anyway. He's rich. We don't need to send him $10 and get the newsletter. Let corporate America do it." That kind of attitude is the attitude that we'll lose. Our challenge is to get all of America behind this, all the smart people with any good ideas on how to design a better boat or spar or sail or piece of equipment. And we doggone better well raise enough money to do the job properly, and we better all get involved or we'll lose. And then you'll be hearing about some your kids will be hearing about somebody still trying to get it back 30 years later because it's over in West Germany. Because if they win, they'll be tough. They don't necessarily play with the same rules that we do. They can, you know, just because we have to, our set of morals and the way we play the game is one thing, but you let somebody else get this and control the rules, you're never going to see that damn thing again. So what you can do is, first of all, you can watch and you can send us all your ideas. If you know anybody that your fathers or mothers are CEOs of a large company that have a product that could help us, anything from a computer to a soap to a anchor company or to a battery company, we need a battery. How about a battery that weighs less, that lasts longer? That type of thing. Or paint. U.S. Paint has a great paint. And so on. So that's what you can do to get involved. And then if nothing else, you can just read about it and say, hey, you know, D.C. was over here and told me all this was going to happen 4 years ago. So I know you all want to get back to class. So before you go, I'll answer a couple of questions and then I'll let you run. No questions? Yes, sir.
The commentary of Frank Grace that we're here was a suggestion that the New York talked about added rights about the Dutch participation in the Australian appeal, but that didn't have proof to make a mistake. Can you comment about that?
Well, they had it right, for sure. And when they finally had the proof, they didn't have the balls to do anything about it because they had already been painted with such a black hat politically and in the media by the common sense and the good PR mechanism of the Australians. They were inept from a, you know, they don't care what you think about them if you really know any of that type. They don't care if you think they're pompous and they think they're aloof and they're better than the rest of you. Some of your fathers, maybe I'll get shot for this, but they don't care, sir, what they think. So that attitude got them in a lot of trouble because this time it did matter what people thought of them. Because even their own members started thinking they were bad guys. So when they finally got the evidence and they got an affidavit from the guy that designed the boat, and he was Dutch, which by the way is against the rules, they didn't have the nerve to stand up and be counted and say, we're not racing you guys, you're cheated. And the event's off. Thing was scheduled for television. Everybody pulled their boats up there to Newport to watch. The bars were full. They didn't have the nerve to call the event off when they had the evidence. Yeah, sure, they had the evidence. And it's common knowledge. Anybody that's read any of the books, it's all in there. Who did the Van and Soonen? A Dutch guy invented the wing keel. And the Dutch tank. It's supposed to be designed by countrymen. Yes, sir.
Yes, in response to the allegation that it's illegal for a foreign designer to design boats, Johan Valentine, who designed some of the boats that were in the Freedom Campaign in 1983, which included the fastest 12-meter that could be built to date, Freedom, which we had at disposal.
Yes. The rules are such that you had to be hold a passport is how they evolved. It started out to be citizens of the country, and then it evolved to be a passport. Was deemed to be a citizen or a resident of the country if you held a passport. And Johan did have an American passport, where Van Osunen, the difference is Van Osunen and the Dutch had Dutch passports. They weren't Australians, and they didn't have an Australian passport. So that, as far as the allegations were concerned, that was the technicality, where Johan was born in another country other than America, and he had an American passport. Where Van Osunen and the people that were involved at the Dutch were not holders of the Australian passport. So I don't know if that answers your question. And as far as Freedom, it was not designed by Johan. It was designed by Sparkman and Stevens.
I understand. To that effect was whether or not he was written to race liberty in 1983.
Well, we raced Liberty because we thought it was the fastest boat. Right. We weren't going to race a slower boat. That wouldn't have made a lot of sense.
It's a dog. I don't think anybody's in Phoenix.
Liberty is a dog relative to Australia, too. But we raced Liberty and Freedom against each other for 2 years in our camp. We own them both. We could erase either boat. So unless you think we're just idiots, believe me, liberty was faster than freedom. Yes, sir.
Dan, is it from May? We've actually met before in Newport. This is on the limits or off. I happen to be here interviewing for my law firm today.
Yes, sir.
I saw the notice. I'm Reed Ashenoff.
Hi.
I'm Alan Bond's lawyer.
Yes, sir.
Representing Australia.
That's fine.
I happen to represent Australia, too, in 83, working with Warren Jones.
I think you did a terrific job, as I said here.
I appreciate it. Just, if I can, for the record, to clear up one or two technicalities, and I think for this particular
Please,
audience,
if I'm wrong, I'd like to hear it.
All right. It's hard to get at the facts sometimes with a Fuhrer, but what we actually did, and I think this audience may be amused as I came out of this institution 15 years ago. Law got heavily involved in 83, and we were called up to Newport. We do all of Mr. Bond's work in this country. Usually it's mergers and acquisitions and securities offerings, and this time it was both. So we went up to Newport in 83, and we're confronted with two things. And a lot of what you said I can relate to, because those Australians were under siege when I got there.
Sure they were.
Foreign country, 12 hours away from home. They couldn't talk to their friends, they couldn't see their girlfriends, and they were here. And what we ended up dealing with on a couple of legal fronts were two issues. One, which is where the boat was designed, and the allegations that it was designed in the Netherlands with Drs. Van Usenen and Mr. Van Sloot, who were the two tank testers from the Netherlands. And the other issue was whether it was a legitimate 12-meter boat. And I think that the applications for law might be intriguing, and I'm not going to get into detail. Suffice it to say that we fought a battle in the press and with daily press releases. We also prepared legal court papers, which we never had to use. We did prepare position papers for the International Yacht Racing Union in London and flew over to London and presented this while the America's Cup race was going on. We presented Dr. Van Usenen's affidavit from the Netherlands. And suffice it to say that the International Yacht Racing Union concluded, number one, that it was a legal 12-meter, which had to do with the wing keel, which was shrouded and under secrecy. And number two, that there was a special ruling issued by the America's Cup Committee to allow what was called tank testing in the Netherlands because of the expensive cost and sophistication of it. A lot of countries that wished to compete didn't have it. And what ultimately happened is that tank testing was allowed in the Netherlands, and Ben Lexen, the designer of Australia 2, went over to the Netherlands and supervised the tank testing and put his designs through tank tests, one of which was his wing keel. And Dr. Van Usenen testified to that by affidavit, and I worked closely with him during that time. And I guess the fact that I'm here on October 21 with Dennis is pure fortuity, although we met in Australia because I went down from the races at Alan's invitation. I want to say, frankly, as an American, I'm proud of you. I think what you did is sensational. But I think back in 83, it was the Australians who were pretty unfairly maligned. And believe it or not, there's a role for good lawyering when it comes to yacht racing, too, from time to time. And more detail than that isn't fair to inflict on you. I just thought you'd be interested in a different view.
And just to amplify on that for a minute, we not only had one attorney, but we had two attorneys on our staff to help prepare for any eventualities, and there was very close to a suit filed against the New Zealanders on the legality of their boat along the lines that of what could have transpired in 1983. So law is certainly a basis, and the America's Cup is in court today. It will be decided by a judge, the future of the Cup, as we speak. And just to, since we're rebutting, sir, I'd like to point out that the ruling that you had that said the wing keel was legal was done verbally and never has been to this date sustained by writing by the head of the International Measurement Committee, who is now dead. So that issue will never, that ruling has never been shown other than verbally. So
actually, what had happened was that the UK contingent, Mr. DeSavory, who I know you know, had gotten a ruling for a wing keel design in Britain that was on paper.
It was said that he had gotten the ruling.
I had it. You never had to go to court, but I had the ruling.
Well, next time you can come work for us. Alan sold all his equipment, so. Yes, sir.
Thanks to the 12-meter game, The sport of sailing has become increasingly professional, and a lot has been written in the sailing publications recently about the concept of professionalism in sailing. Could you comment about that, especially based on your historical background of being a real Corinthian sailor?
Well, the best sailors involved in ocean racing have been in the business anyway. So they've been, the best sailors are sailmakers and boat builders. They're all making their living out of it anyway. So I don't understand what is a professional. This gentleman here is, that just spoke, has made more money out of sailing than I have. I didn't get paid to do it.
Actually, we pretty much helped him.
Well, maybe that's not out of context too, but the point here is that what is a professional? If professional means that businesses and can get involved and market their product by being associated with yachting, yes, it's definitely becoming more professional. If it means the best sailors in yachting are going to now be paid for their work, well, they've been paid for their work all along.
Yes.
John Bertrand, the guy that sailed Australia 3, is paid by Alan Bond. And so was all the people that raced from New Zealand and Australia this time. Alan Bond's guy, that's what he does for a living now. Colin Bischel works for Alan Bond. He's paid staff, and the same with most of the other skippers of the 12-meter boats. But that's been going on for a long, since history. The guy that really sailed the boats in 1851 was a professional. He was a professional crew. The boats were sailed by professionals, and the amateurs, Sir Thomas Lipton, rode around on a boat sailed by someone else. So professionalism, if a guy sailing on the boat is professionalism, that's been here a long time. So when you read about professionalism, most people are talking about in the form of business sponsoring a boat or being involved, and that's pretty much here and accepted. The boats that sailed in England at the World's Ocean Racing Championships and the Solent all had sponsored names and spinnakers on the boats, and it's here. It's like tennis. Or Wimbledon used to be, if you got paid, I guess if you won a prize, you couldn't go in Wimbledon. What would Wimbledon be today if Rod, if Martina and Lindell couldn't come? So it's here, and it's coming and sailing, and if you don't like it, it's too bad. There's really nothing wrong with it. It's not going to change your involvement in the sport or anyone's involvement. They'll still be able to go race a J24 or a Shields or an Etchells and have fun. It won't change anything. It'll just help share the burden. American people can't come up with $35 million for a defense. If you don't want corporate America here involved, then just give the cup back. Because we can't do it with a 501c3. Yes, sir.
I have two questions. The first one is, can you talk at all about why it wasn't picked as the site, why it wasn't safe?
Well, Hawaii didn't win the America's Cup, number one. San Diego did.
Right.
That was one big reason. Do you think that, could you see the New York Yacht Club sending the event to Hawaii because the winds are light in Newport, Rhode Island?
No,
well, that's number one.
I was under the impression that, at least in the newspapers, I had read that I believe your name was mentioned. It may not have been that it was actually, there were a lot of economic and also other advantages going down to Hawaii.
Economic, there are none. Corporate America wants the event in San Diego, because they can take their clients there, they can entertain there, they can have sponsorships there, they can have sweepstake winners go there. It's a much, egress is a much bigger thing for corporate America. Television would like to see it in Hawaii, but television doesn't pay any of the bill. The total contract last time for the America's Cup from ESPN, $1.1 million. That was split amongst the yacht club and 26 competitors. Our check, to the best of my knowledge, was $16,000 we got from television. So if you think that's a driving factor, you're wrong. Not television. And then there's so many other factors in the America's Cup, as I just mentioned. Do you think egress is important, that somebody should be able to go and watch the race if they want? Well, in Hawaii, if you have a 100-foot boat, you can't even get in the harbor. There's no place to go for any of you who've been there. There's no place to tie up. And do you think it's important? I happen to think it's important that the people that supported this event get to go and watch. A lot of regular people like yourselves gave us money, $35, to get our newsletter. Do you think it's right they have to go spend $2,000 to go watch the event in Hawaii, or to be able to be nicer for them to be able to ride a bus or take their family there and go and watch in San Diego? And how about all the hundreds of people that it takes to put on the event for 6 months? The logistics involved are tremendous. The housing, on and on and on. San Diego is the best place to have it. That's why they got it.
The other thing was, I was wondering if you could comment on the lawsuit.
The lawsuit, I should let you do this because you probably already know all about this. And I'm in a rough group to start talking about the law. So the best of my knowledge is that Michael Fay read the original deed of gift. He read the Constitution of the United States with regard to the America's Cup. And in there, he saw a line that said, a challenge may be entered with a vessel of sated size, less than 90 feet on the world water line, and at a specified date. And that the defending club may name the place, and that this challenge has to be dispensed with before any others can be entertained, or words to that effect. He didn't care about tradition, and he didn't care about the fact that the challengers all raced against each other to see who the official challenger is. As a matter of fact, how do you think his odds would be if he has to go race 24 other guys to be the official challenger? So if he can eliminate 24 just with the help of a barrister, that's a hell of a deal, isn't it? So that's what he did. And number two, if he can have this plan and have this boat, this 170-foot boat that he'd like to race with, already up and built and up underway before he even challenges, and he only has 7 months to prepare, how does that do for his chances of winning the cup? And when the San Diego Yacht Club told him to go jump in the lake, that wasn't going to happen. He's suing them because they're saying they don't living up to their fiduciary responsibility as the defender of the cup, and they should forfeit the cup to him, and he should just take it home without a race. So the idea is not that it's a sporting competition anymore. It's just whoever can win the cup. He doesn't care how he gets the cup. He gets to take that thing to his island. He started a yacht club off the coast of Auckland, 30 miles from downtown Auckland. He's the Commodore by some strange coincidence. There's 30 members of the yacht club, and no one's ever heard of it. So he's going to take the cup and run that cup for the good of New Zealand and Michael Fay. That's what's fun about this. If it was easy, now who would we want to play? So he's a tough competitor. I'm not mad at him for doing this. That's just the name of the game here. He's going to try to win any way he can. So what do? We call up our bank of 30 attorneys, you know, and we have the maritime attorney, and we got legals, and we got all the beagles in the world, all down there in the Superior Court of New York, lining up here. And so we say, well, this is, file a brief like this. And here's all the reasons why you're not supposed to get this. I mean, this is custom as this, and the cup is a very happy cup the way it's been come to be run. And everybody likes the spirit of competition and competing to be the challenger. Da, 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 da. And by the way, if we do have to go by the word of the law, by the way, Mr. So-and-so here of so-and-so and so-and-so, let me introduce you. I mean, could you tell us your qualifications? Oh, yes, I'm a legal. I'm 42 years of maritime law. And my esteemed opinion, and as well as the opinion of the esteemed counsel from New Zealand, is a vessel, as stated in the deed of gift, vessel is a yacht or ship presently under commission, which means it's afloat. And Mr. Fay challenged with a boat that was a figment of his imagination. So if the judge wants to go by the written rule of the law and interpret it word for word, he doesn't have a challenge because he doesn't have a vessel. And if she wants to go by reality and custom and how the law really is over the years, he's screwed that way either. So I don't think he's going to be racing in 7 months in a 170-foot boat. And if he does, we're going to set the course in 18 feet of water because his boat drives. How's it sound? When Rome do as the Romans do. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a sailing question and a legal question. Could you comment on the implications of a refereeing system versus an appeal system for conflict resolution?
I'm not thrilled with a referee because that means your referee better be every bit as good a sailor as you are. And you better see every angle of the course. So that's going to be above, below, and ahead and behind. And you better be every bit as good a sailor as the people on the course. First of all, there aren't any judges that are as good as the people sailing the boats. And second of all, how can he see 365 degrees ahead and above and below? So I'd rather have the destiny at least somewhat under my control by evidence that I could present. Would you like to have go through life and then have just some guy following you around behind you decide if you shouldn't have, if you cut in front of that car or he slammed on his brakes? That doesn't sound very good. So I'm not, they're going to have to improve it before I'd vote for it. I don't think you'll see it in the next America's Cup. Yes, sir?
Are you going to skip this time?
Why not? It's the best game in town. It's fun.
Will you be in fiberglass?
Probably, because fiberglass is I don't want to say any more about it. Let's put it this way. You can push the rules further with fiberglass. I'm going to see that Michael Fay's boat's got his cord before I'm done, because they're selling that boat to the Japanese, and I'm friendly with the Japanese, so I'm going to get the moment that escrow is closed, I'm going to have a Grayson bid on that boat, and I'll get a core of it. I'm going to show you all that what I said was right. Yes, sir.
Do you plan to use the same design team management of that design team?
Well, I have John Marshall, and he's the key to it. He's the brains of the outfit. And Britt Chance is smart, and so they're all smart. I don't want to get in trouble, but they may not all be back. For one thing, I'm a little mad at Dave Pedrick because he's working for the Japanese. So one of our three designers is working for the Japanese. They have the money. I can't really blame him. But it's hard for me to take him back with open arms. So I think I'll have Chance and Nelson and with Marshall running it, and all pretty much a lot of the same consultants. So I'll have a similar format to last time. Yes, sir. He's a consultant, just like Mr. Osunen. He's just a consultant. There'll be a Japanese guy that will sign it, just like Ben Lexen signed it.
Okay. Can you confirm the reports that the American camp as well had photographs of the keel when it was being measured?
Which boat was this? No, we didn't. We didn't even. New York Yacht Club didn't even send anybody to the measuring. That's how confident they were. There was no one representing the New York Yacht Club. There was an American measurer, but he is supposed to be, and was, completely unbiased. The New York Yacht Club didn't send anyone to the measuring of Australia too. So the answer is no, we didn't have the pictures, and we didn't really know what it looked like till they took the keel off, the cover off. Alan never should have uncovered the keel because we never would have had pictures of it. It would have been harder for us to catch up. He never should have taken the cover off the keel. That helped us a lot.
I know that a lot of the other camps had photographs.
We didn't have photographs until the end, until he took the cover off. Wouldn't have helped us anyway. It wasn't anything we could do. We just would have psyched us out even more because we were astonished at what it really looked like. I was flabbergasted. That thing was that. That's what beat us. I just like the rest of everyone else. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, he is full of it. He was wetting his pants. Ask his teammates. Ask Chink Longley or Ben Lexen if you think I'm kidding. They won't even speak to him. He needed one. He needed one. That's why he had it. Ask Ben Lexen. Read Ben Lexen's book and find out what really happened. Or go talk to Alan Bond or Chink Longley, the guys that ran near Syndicate, and find out what they think of Bertrand, whether he was psyched out or not.
Well,
speak, yes.
What do you think about the idea of those?
If you need it, fine. It's why not leave anything unturned?
There was a lot of talk about uncovering the keel during the races. We talked about it a lot. And the thought was that this greater-than-life mystery was worth keeping a mystery, and that was a strategic decision.
I think that was a good idea.
In terms of Bertrand and psyching, what I can say that Dennis is too modest to say is that the general consensus is that Dennis Connor is the finest sailor in the world. that's general consensus held by the Australians. There's been no evidence to indicate that's wrong. I think that's why America won three races against the fastest boat in 83. And I think anybody who sailed against Dennis Conner has a long way to go uphill, come up to an even psychological point. And I have to add that in tribute to this man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, but Dennis Conner has a great team. He has John Marshall, he has Tom Whidden, he has the best sailors, the best sailmakers, the best boat builders. I have a tremendous team. I wouldn't want to race us either, not because of Dennis. Yes, sir?
You going to get Billy Peterson on board again?
Billy Peterson wasn't on board. He was on the sailmaking team.
I'm making your sails here.
I haven't thought about it, really. But he was a good guy, and he did his job, but he wasn't key. Someone else could have done that same job. Key guys were Marshall, the design team, Tom Whidden. Those are guys that are hard to replace. Not that Billy wasn't, you know, I don't mean to take anything away from him. He was a key part of the team, but someone else could have done that job. Yes?
You're just tooling around, kind of fun sailing. What's your favorite boat to sail in?
Well, the best boat to sail is a star boat. Want to race better, much better than a 12 meter, and I don't really like to sail, so I don't go sailing. I'm not kidding you. I don't like. I'd much rather do something else. I'm having more fun talking to you all. I don't like sailing because I've sailed 40 years. Do you think Mario Andretti likes driving to the store for a loaf of bread? Really? I mean, or would he just as soon stay home and watch this World Series and send his kids who had a learner's permit?
How many defenders are defending syndicates?
We don't know. No others yet. They'll be there, though. That's the American way. Somebody will come and keep Dennis honest. They're not going to just let him have a walkover. And I think it's good. They'll push us. We need competition. Yes, ma'am.
Coming from New Zealand, I'm just interested in knowing why it is you can convince that New Zealand boat was illegal.
I didn't say I was convinced that it was. I just said there's some possibility of it, and one of the reasons that added to that is that they wouldn't let us measure it. If it was legal, why wouldn't they let us measure it? That's all I wanted to do, just measure it and see that it's legal. I would have let them drill a hole in my boat and see if it was quarter inch aluminum was quarter inch aluminum, or if I had some.
They wanted to drill a hole into the hull.
Yeah, I wanted to take a sample of the hull to see if it was what it was supposed to be.
But what made you think that it was illegal? That's my question.
Because I know enough about fiberglass, and I know it's very difficult to build a boat of fiberglass that is uniform in weight, even when you're trying. If you're any of the sailors here, if you know what a laser is, or lasers weigh about 100 pounds, but out of the same mold with the same people building it and the measured amounts of resin and cloth, lasers weigh 10% different. One laser weighs 108 pounds, some weigh 98, even when you're trying to build them the same. It's very difficult to control fiberglass construction. Especially when you know the cures under different temperatures. It's so technical to tell you. The amount of pressure you put on against the cloth, different amounts of resin run out. Very difficult to control when you're trying to. All I wanted to be is make sure I was racing a 12-meter. And it would have been very hypocritical of me not to stand up and be counted when I'm mad at the New York Yacht Club for not standing up and taking this gentleman to court and let him prove they have a legal 12-meter. I'm still mad about it. How can a 12-meter that can't draw any more than 9 feet be legal when it can't sail in 9 feet of water? Tell me about that.
I think this is your form.
Literally, how do you like this? You guys are smart. The rule says that a 12-meter, the draft shall be no more than 12 feet. In other words, 9 feet. In other words, it can't be deeper than 9 feet. Well, the boat can't sail in 9 feet of water. The second it is over 1 inch, it's aground because the wings hit, because the wings make the boat deeper than 9 feet. Does that seem right? Didn't seem right to me. But they came up with some mysterious ruling from a guy that was dead.
That's what they call a good lawyer.
Congratulations. No, I'm not mad at the Australians. It was the greatest thing that ever happened. I'm a good friend of Allen's and Warren's. I think they're the greatest competitors in the world. We like each other personally. We just love to beat each other.
Would you be in favor of a say, a lower or a low ceiling on the budgets for each of the competitors to make it...
No, that's part of the game.
So you think you like it when somebody has just a limited...
Harder the better. Make it as hard as you can. That's what I like. If it was easy, I don't want to play. I think it's good that it's hard. And if somebody wants to win bad enough, if the Japanese want to win bad enough to spend $180 million on it trying to beat us, it's going to be that much more satisfying to whip their fannies.
But for you, then, it's part of the competition, just the trying. You said it was very difficult to raise the money.
Sure it is. If it was easy, anyone could do it. Wouldn't you all like to go out and spend $100 million on some game? It'd be fun, wouldn't it?
If you had the opportunity to change the rules, the design rules, it was just up to you, what would you change?
I'm not technically oriented. I just play the game. They're changing the rules all the time. I'll just play. Besides, I can't ever do it. I've got my hands full worrying about what I can control and not worrying about suppositions. I don't think they should have changed the rules, but they did, and I'm not going to worry about it. I've got to play with the game now. They changed it so the keels can move. You can have as many rudders as you want. You can build out of fiberglass. I think it was hard enough before without spending another $20 million on trying to make... Can you imagine what it's going to be like making the bottom of your wings on the bottom of your keel articulate going over every wave, computer controlled based on the size of the sea? Think what they've done to it. It's going to be hard.
Criticism of San Diego was the light winds or the problem of the winds. How do you think that's going to affect the race?
Well, first of all, how many people ever criticized Newport for 132 years for having light winds? I never heard it. Did you? Did you ever hear anybody criticize Newport because they have light winds? I'm asking you, just rhetorically. The answer is it's going to be just fine then, isn't it? And the best racing that I've ever experienced in 12-meter has been in light winds. The most exciting race in history in a 12-meter was in 6 knots of wind when they won the America's Cup. They passed us downwind. That was a heck of a lot more exciting than any race you saw in Perth. The best racing in 12-meter is downwind in light air. You can pass. It's hard to defend. It's exciting. So when you're watching on television, you'll like the racing better in light wind than strong wind. The only people that are going to like the strong winds are the ones that don't know about sailing. And your wife says, oh, isn't that wonderful, darling? Look how they're crashing off those waves. Or the guy that's sitting there waiting for someone to fall overboard and drown. You know, that mentality. There's always that, too. But the people that like sailing and like drama and like to be on the inside of the quarterback and hear Sims calling the plays at the Super Bowl, they're going to like it in light air because it'll be a lot tougher and more tension in the cockpit in light air in the cup. You never heard me sound like I was too nervous about the America's Cup. And it was a piece of cake. Boat was fast. We just went off straight line, tacked for the mark. No tactics. I guess I am getting the sign to quit, right? The instructor says you have to go back to class. One more question. Up there in the back.
Hypothetically, how would the race get back to Newport?
For America to lose and for a yacht club to win from the United States that wanted to race in Newport. That's why the New York Yacht Club, they're helping the New Zealanders, frankly. There's a lot of people that in the New York Yacht Club that would like to see San Diego lose as soon as possible. So they can have a whack at getting it back. Because as long as it's in America, just like when I raced for the New York Yacht Club, when I sailed Courageous in 83, and when I sailed Liberty and Freedom, I was racing for the New York Yacht Club. When I won the America's Cup, or successfully defended it in 1980, the cup didn't go to San Diego. So as long as it stays in America, the San Diego Yacht Club can decide where it could go. Now, in theory, they could take it to Newport. If it doesn't work out successfully in San Diego, that may very well be what they do. Certainly would be under consideration, in my opinion. So it could go there that way. But if for sure you want to get it back in Newport, then start your own yacht club and go raise the money as soon as San Diego Yacht Club loses. And then go try to win it. Then you can have it there. So I'd say thank you all for coming, and I hope when you get your degrees, you'll come sign up and defend me of all the trouble I get myself in.